Now, Human Rights Day, of course, commemorates the Sharpeville massacre that took place on the 21st of March, 1960, when 69 people were killed during a protest against the hated pass laws. It's a day that reminds us all that we now have a constitution that, among others, protects our human rights, that we have a right to move freely without a passport, that we're all equal before the law, and that we are all also entitled to basic human dignity. Well, to help us commemorate this day, and to look back through their own lives, I am joined on the line by former Constitutional Court Judge Albi Sachs, whose career in human rights activism, of course, began a long time ago when he was at the tender age of 17. I'm also, as I told you earlier, joined on the line by Jeremy Vuri, a former member of Mkhonto Sizwe, and of course also Nelson Mandela's former bodyguard. Jeremy was arrested for his involvement in Mkhonto Sizwe operations in South Africa in 1987, and sent to prison on Robben Island. He was released from prison in 1990 after the unbanning of the ANC and the beginning of talks to end apartheid. Gentlemen, good evening. A very big warm welcome to the Karima Brown Show.
Good evening, Karima, and good evening to the listeners.
Hi, Justice Sachs, are you there?
Yeah, you can call me Judge Albi.
Judge Albi, good evening. Welcome to the program. Justice Sachs, can we hear you?
Yes, I'm waiting for the question.
Okay. My apologies. I thought I was not, you wouldn't be able to hear me. But let me start off with you. Of course, there's a lot of reflection on days like today about how far we've come, about what is wrong in our society, what the urgent gaps are. But I want to start a little bit before we do that kind of look back, particularly with you. If one looks at the kind of origins of this push around locating the struggle against apartheid, the struggle against colonialism, the struggle for sovereignty within a human rights context, where would you locate, that origin? Where would you locate that? And how did it find expression in a process that got us to the kind of constitution that was ultimately the result of a negotiation? We didn't have an outright victory against the apartheid state. This constitution had to be negotiated. It is as a result of also a series of compromises that needed to be made. Take us back to the origin and then just that journey of how we got to where we are today.
Okay, well, first of all, I'm old enough to remember Sharpeville. I was in Cape Town. And we were kind of shocked. We were stunned. It was ugly. It was brutal, even by South African standards. And a week later, it was that famous march led by Philip Hosana, where maybe 20, 30,000 Africans, mainly young men, came right to the center of town. They could have taken over Parliament. But they were told, come back tomorrow. We'll give you a chance to speak to the Minister of Justice. They went home and they woke up in the morning, state of emergency, surrounded by police, army, sailors, everything. And from then onwards, thousands of people were locked up. And making March 21st Human Rights Day is to commemorate all the people who died in so many different episodes in achieving freedom. But I wouldn't say we framed the Constitution in a human rights context. We framed the Constitution in the context of national liberation, getting rid of a system of white supremacy, destroying apartheid as an organized political system. It went well beyond simply human rights, like civil rights. Civil rights was the consequence of what we did, but the methodology was self-determination for the majority, equality for everybody. We had to fight so hard against group rights because the other side wanted to have a parliament based on different racial groups, ethnic groups. We would have had three presidents, Mandela on Monday, and de Klerk on Tuesday, and Buthelezi on Wednesday. I'm exaggerating. It would have been six months. And they would have to get consensus on everything. And the whole struggle was to avoid racial minority group rights, which would have meant a white veto. That was the battle. That was the struggle. And we won that battle. We destroyed that whole idea of group rights, and we got a democratic South Africa, which meant majority rule, majority or black majority rule, but not because they're black, because it's a democratic country with votes for everybody. When it came to protections, the protections didn't come from group rights, they came from a Bill of Rights. And that's where the rights theme became so essential. And that was Oliver Tambo's view, and it was not a compromise at all. This whole notion that somehow things were difficult for us, we had to make all sorts of compromises, doesn't reflect the two-stage process we had of making the Constitution. And the big thing was to get from the table at Kodesa, Kempton Park, where it was difficult for us, to a democratically elected parliament that would draft the final Constitution. And that was drafted by people overwhelmingly black, by people in a strong position now, they'd been elected into office, and by people in the majority who'd been in the struggle. So I don't feel that it's fair to say that there were problems with the Constitution. If you read it carefully, and anybody from outside reading it can see it's a Constitution for change, for transformation. The problem with the Constitution is not in the text and compromises, so-called, that were made. Mm. It's in the application. And that has important consequences because the Constitution was made by the actions of millions and millions of people. And it, when it comes ultimately to enforcing and applying the Constitution, making it meaningful, we're going to need millions of people involved in that process again.
Jeremy, before I come to you, I want to ask Albie an important question around why it was so important to have a strong unitary state, considering, of course, that we had a system of Bantustans, of homelands. What was the rationale around the importance of having a strong unitary state with powers to effect equality, to bring in the majority that have historically been locked out?
You know, it was both practical to prevent white minorities from ruling and controlling everything in the way that they'd done, whether it was done nationally or whether it was done through local, what they call self-government areas. We had to have a single South Africa. But it was more than that, Karima. It was spiritual. It was conceptual. Mm. It was dignity for everybody. And to destroy the organized system of white supremacy, we couldn't have enclaves that were constitutionally protected under the guise of cantons or provinces or whatever it might be. So united South Africa meant not only no Bantustans and no group areas and no District 6 removals and things like that, it also meant one person, one vote, we were all equal. That was the important thing. We didn't call it a unitary state, and there's a difference between a unitary state and a united state.
Albie, we just lost you a little bit. I think your phone we couldn't pick your voice up. If you could just repeat that important distinction.
No, I was giving instructions to the driver. I'm being driven here. This is really on the hoof, except it's a four-wheeled hoof.
We completely understand, and we're very grateful that you're multitasking. Yes.
It was quite an important difference. We didn't constitutionalize a united South Africa. Mm. A unitary state. That was controversial. We wanted devolution. We wanted provinces to be important. We wanted municipalities to be important. It's more democratic. So we call it a united South Africa. United is not a constitutional form. It means unity of the people. And everybody counts as a human being, not as a black or white or majority minority. It meant, in practice, black majority rule because black people are the majority. Now, that was the battle we fought for through the two-stage process of constitution making. That's the battle that we won. And that's why today our constitution has been so remarkable in the sense of not solving the problems of life of the people, but giving the people a voice, accountability, compelling the president to step down because he'd be answerable to parliament, the courts playing a very important role, elections being important in this country. Elections are important because we have an IEC that's independent. We have a judicial service commission that ensures that we have brilliant judges. So I feel very proud this day of our constitution, even although I'm ashamed of so many things that were done in the name of government, in the name of leadership, by people who should have known a lot better. And I'm excited to see the mechanisms of the constitution are working now to deal with corruption, to deal with state capture, to at least give us a chance to breathe and to restore principles of integrity and morality into public life. It doesn't give people the homes they're entitled to, the security they're entitled to, The question of the land is now on the table. It's there. We can have a huge national debate about it, long overdue. But the issue of doing something dramatic and drastic about the land can't be avoided any longer. So my answer is, and as you can see, I'm very, very proud of the Constitution, the Constitutional Court, and our generation. We weren't forced to make sordid compromises simply to get the vote. We led a, I think, a beautifully managed, a very powerful, with huge popular support, process of transforming what was a racist, authoritarian, ethnically driven state into a democracy that is pungent, that works, that's robust. But we have to use that democracy now for the second revolution, if you like, the second stage of revolution in the social lives of the people, more access to land, to opportunities. We've got to destroy a culture of covert racial supremacy that's still very, very strong in this country. But the big point for me is we can use the Constitution to do that. The Constitution is not a barrier to that.
Absolutely. And obviously your own life in many ways mirrors that struggle. Your personal commitment, your involvement is very well recorded as an activist, as a member of the African National Congress. You were in exile. You suffered tremendously. And part of what we're trying to do in the show today is also to talk about the celebration of human rights through the stories, the personal journeys of the individuals that were active participants in shaping this new South Africa. And that's where you also come in, Jeremy. You were born into a politically active family in Alsace River. You come from Cape Town, of course. And you have had a history both in student organization, in the Black Consciousness Movement, later on becoming part of the African National Congress. And of course, you become involved at a time when you are teaching in South Africa. Just quickly take us through your own conscientization and how that culminates, Jeremy, in you becoming an active member of Mkhonto we Sizwe that is eventually captured by the old apartheid police, put on trial and sent to Robben Island.
Good evening, Karima, and good evening to the listeners. Actually, my conscientization was seeded by my mother, who was a shop steward in the Garment Workers Union and quite a militant one in the clothing industry and in Alsace River in particular at Schwito and Libra factory. So I, from a very young age, was exposed to what union politics was about, to seeing the power of a factory in Schwito, like Schwito or in Libra, standing still due to the power of what people like my mother and the workers with her organizing to the Garment Workers Union were representing. So my politics came from a different field. And in later years, long before I got to know of the ANC, it became quite influenced by a very workerist type of notion of change and that type of thinking, and that being the primary basis for my ideological thinking at the time. At school, I was also exposed at the time also the schools in Alsace River when I eventually reached high school in about in the late 70s to 80s, mid 70s to 80s. The high schools that I was at in the Alsace River were entirely dominated by Black Consciousness, by the Black Consciousness Movement. Senior activists of the Black Consciousness Movement, some of them were residents in Alsace River, and they were the leadership figures who politicized our student politics at the time. So that just briefly, my exposure to the ANC, for that matter, incidentally came via the church, the Moravian Church in particular. And it is at the youth camps of the Moravian Church where I met people like Cecil Iso, people like even some my own age, like Tuan Anthony Diedrichs. I'm the senior member of the Communist Party today in the Western Cape, and many other activists who were very active in Congress politics. And it's through that, and at in the church at that time, in the youth organization of which I became a member, there there was quite an active ideological struggle between the older Unity Movement Guard and the new emerging Congress people. And this occurred at the time when the UDF was also beginning to emerge as a united front. And the church youth organizations, we from the Moravian Church, we became aligned, and our first type of campaigns with the Million Signature Campaign and these issues started getting us involved beyond our narrow sectoral politics of the church, of only student organizations, into the terrain of civic organization and issues that affect broader than just student issues. So one of the first campaigns I remember that I learned about the broader way of looking at things and a broader way of organizing was the Disorderly Bills Action Committee campaign at the time, and issues like the Fatih Moni's boycott. So I began to see things broader than just the sectoral or maybe sectarian politics to which I was exposed in the earlier parts of my life. And it's in that process in late 83 of the Moravian camp that I was recruited into Umkhonto to Wesizwe.
And you eventually end up in a big unit that, of course, was active in the Western Cape. You were arrested, captured, and sent to Robben Island, Jeremy.
Yes. We were arrested. Myself was part of a particular group. They termed us the Fighting 15 or Terror 15, depending on who you're talking to at the time. But it was led by our commander, Ashley Forbes, at the time, and our political commissar at the time, Peter Jacobs. And we were part of the Northern Suburbs infrastructure, a few units. And then the northern suburbs MK infrastructure in that. But it was a province-wide type of structure, as you evidently saw if you study the backgrounds and the places we all came from who constituted that group on trial.
Now, the reason why I chose both Albie Sachs and yourself as guests for this evening is because your lives are very much an embodiment of this struggle for liberation. And both of you were also active in the initial and continue to be active in various parts of government and work around realizing freedom. Albie, you served, obviously, as a constitutional court judge. There is sometimes a perception when the democratic breakthrough is critiqued that what we have come up with is somehow selling us short of justice, that we sued for peace, but we didn't necessarily end up with justice. Are you comfortable with that critique? Is that how you would sum it up, particularly if you look at what it is that you try to do as part of a coterie of constitutional court judges to give life to what is enshrined in the Constitution?
You know, can I just mention two little things? First of all, I have a connection with Jeremy. My father, Solly Sachs, was the founder and general secretary of the Garment Workers Union. And I don't think the unions get enough credit for being the main incubators of democracy in South Africa. They elected their shop stewards.
Good point.
They controlled their money. They got across divisions of ethnicity, of race, of gender. The Food and Canning Workers Union, the garment workers were mainly women. And that's something that Jeremy and I, growing up on different divides of apartheid, but we had in common. In terms of the peace, for me, a very important part of my life was being in revolutionary Mozambique. Frelimo didn't sue for peace. They negotiated the withdrawal of the Portuguese. They declared the new constitution. There was one party in control. We all shouted Viva. We thought it was fantastic. And it couldn't be sustained. Mm. And the country ended up in civil war. And, you know, I lost an arm in a bomb put in my car by South African security agents. I survived. Mozambique saved my life. But the country is full of people who lost limbs to mines, landmines. And it still hasn't recovered from the civil war. South Africa, we avoided all that. So it's not like suing for peace. It's not just being nice to the whites. It's not kowtowing to anybody. It's showing that black majority rule works, that democracy is the only way forward for South Africa. That was all achieved. But I think people became some lazy, others became greedy. When you said Jeremy was captured, the word captured had a different meaning in those days to what it has today. It's sad that some of the captured have now become the capturers. But in terms of justice, justice is not doing to them what they did to us. Then you're just like them. That's not justice. The spirit of Ubuntu, restorative justice, means transformation and change, but developing the country for everybody. And I still feel that we have the mechanisms for doing that through the Constitution, through using Parliament, amending the Constitution if necessary, and always dialogue, dialogue, dialogue. Dialogue doesn't mean compromise. It means looking into the eyes of the other and finding solutions where you can go forward to break some of the still systemic forms of control and domination that exist covertly, even though legally they've been destroyed.
Absolutely. Now, I want to bring Jeremy in here. Jeremy, of course, you found yourself in the early 90s in the ANC's intelligence structures, but you later then become part of a post-apartheid South African police service, having to confront very many of the people who hunted you during your days as an Umkhonto we Sizwe soldier, and having to work in a new integrated police force that serves a democratic and a constitutional order. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, I want you to think during the break about what was the most difficult thing for you to do when you became part of that new integrated police force. Jeremy, so how big a challenge was it for an Umkhonto we Sizwe operative, a bodyguard of Nelson Mandela, someone who worked in the ANC's intelligence branch, to now work with people in the South African police service after, you know, those services were reconstructed to serve a new constitutional order?
Karima, I think just to start at a broader basis here on the issue, you must understand in the context of the time, it's on the 11th of May 1994 that our first minister in a democratic government for policing, Minister Mafumadi, was appointed. And the response to him and to us coming in at the time was quite clearly expressed by Lieutenant General during at that time in the KwaZulu-Natal. When he said on the 27th of May, quote, I want to quote him, we the police agencies are ultimately the unquestionable guarantors of institutional stability, not the SDUs, MK, APLA, trainees, or the like. So what you heard there is a general reflection of primarily the way most generals who were in charge of this new moving towards this new police service, how they looked at us. In particular, the second challenge was we were not dealing with one organization here, but we were the common enemy to all of them. We were dealing with 11 police agencies who had just amalgamated, 10 of them from the homelands, with the South African Police Force being the oldest one. So we found ourselves in a situation, the few that we were as deployed cadres, facing quite a broad front of resistance against us. But at a personal level, being a cadre of Umkhonto we Sizwe, I was quite the first day I stepped in and when I integrated and I had the honor of meeting my interrogators, and so did Peter Jacobs and so did all of us. We actually met the people who tortured us and whom some of us would later testify against in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission while being inside the police. So you can understand the challenges that we face. We face, in some cases, I know one comrade of us whose partner on the old security police side, because we had integrated into the crime intelligence wing, or the old branch, if you could put it that way, could not even consider the possibility of driving in the same car with him for and clearly racist reasons.
Absolutely,
so these
Jeremy.
Are the kind of challenges that we face. Yeah,
absolutely, I've got to have good radio manners. I'm so loath to interrupt this because it's such an important part of the journey. But we've got to go to the news. It's 9 o'clock. I'm going to ask both you and Albie to indulge me to stay with us. We would like to conclude this conversation just till after the 9 o'clock. It is Human Rights Day. Our focus this evening on the evolution of human rights within the context of national liberation. We're also looking back at just how far we've come and what we obviously still need to do. Coming up in this hour of the program, we conclude our discussion of earlier. My guests, of course, a former member of Mkhonto we Sizwe and Nelson Mandela's former bodyguard and currently a member of the South African Police Services, Jeremy Viery, as well as former constitutional court judge, activist, and of course, longtime member of the African National Congress, Albie Sachs. And then later on, we speak with the CEO of the Nelson Mandela Foundation, Mr. Sello Hatang, as well as two of our listeners, Ludwig Kazi and Vuiswa. Both of them were our winners last night. They called in to explain what their understanding of human rights were, and they were the best among the listeners who called in. They won two tickets to the Apartheid Museum. They were at the discussion and listened to the panel discussion and participated in the reflection of quite a provocative title. We looked at whether President Nelson Mandela's government and leadership set the country up for failure. And they, of course, going to be telling us how they experienced that debate and what they understand the challenges are that still lie ahead so many years after the democratic breakthrough in 1994. And then, of course, we open the lines as we always do at around 9:30, and we get you to talk to us about what's on your mind, to share your thoughts, and to, of course, also input on the debate. The number to dial, 011-883-0702. You can SMS me, of course, on 31702. And you can send your WhatsApp messages and voice notes to 072-702-1702.
Karima Brown on 702.
Albie Sachs, Jeremy Viery, thank you so very much for indulging me. And as I was saying before the news, I would have loved for Jeremy to just continue with that thought. But, you know, in radio, we work according to a clock and a format, and it was at the top of the hour and we had to go to the news. But Jeremy, you were talking about, of course, integrating, and some of the difficulties and some of the challenges, that, you faced. And you were reminding us, for those of you who were listening and for those of you who've just joined us, Jeremy was talking, through having to, of course, face some of the people who tortured, who were the opponents before the democratic breakthrough, having to face them whilst now being part of the same police service, because there was, of course, an integration of the various forces into the creation of a new South African police service. And you were still explaining about the fact that one of your colleagues was simply not able to share a working space and even take a drive in a car because of the naked racism that you guys have still experienced. If you could just kind of pick up the story from there, Jeremy.
Okay, I think what I'm saying, the subjective experiences that we had, like I said, to sit face to face with the torture is one thing, but the issue of you must understand, we were dealing with the sharp edge of the state security apparatus who we fought as enemies merely a year before we integrated, you know, historically. And there were people who simply, let alone the racism, could not refer to us as terrorists.
Mm.
And despite the fact that people like myself, I was a colonel at that point in time, given the seniority of coming over from the movement, there was great challenges in terms of people accepting my command. And I was head of the intelligence, of the covert intelligence unit at the time. And some of the people just refused and left and resigned. And those that stayed were people whom we had to lead into a new way of doing things. Whom we, the few that we were, we had to lead the reconciliation process inside the police and actually take a step back and for the sake of working together, we had to bear these things and still put a smile on our faces and still try to reunite everybody under our command, despite some racism towards us, to actually serve and fight crime together. So, I mean, there's a positive thing in the sense that we do not say we solved all the contradictions historically when it came to those things, looking at it now, because we folks face similar challenges. But it's significant that we were able to get through that period in a way without us killing each other.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jeremy was explaining graphically what it actually meant to build one police service. I think a lot of people who critique that period are not often aware of what it was that had to be reconstructed and built. I was speaking to a Treasury official a few evenings ago around, for example, having to recover from state capture, having to rebuild institutions. And one of the things he said to me is, Karima, the importance of the Treasury cannot be overstated. We had 19 treasuries, if you like, and we had to put it together, make it work, and of course, let it serve the purposes of a new democratic constitutional order. And the fact that it was destroyed so fast and so quickly by corrupt leaders obviously makes the task of rebuilding all the more difficult. From where you're sitting, as someone who served at the Constitutional Court, the kind of legal basis around apartheid and having to reconstruct and build a criminal justice system, a justice system based on different values, new laws. How challenging was that, Albi? And more importantly, how did we do? Because many people still believe that because people can't access justice, that very little has changed. And of course, that is not true either.
You know, we were in a totally different country, just the way people walk in the streets, address yes. each other, speak their minds. It's a different South Africa. For all the, sometimes I put it when the chains dropped, the pinpricks, the shackles dropped, the pinpricks became unbearable. Mm. It's not to say what's happening now is a pinprick in itself, but compared to the oppression of the past, there's been a huge change. When people were complaining that drug power is being raided, things haven't changed at all, there was a search warrant. He was able to contact the press. The case is still kind of pending. In those days, we would be hauled off, thrown into jail. I was, without trial, without contact with lawyers, steep deprivation. Those things were all part and parcel of standard practice then. What we also had to reconstruct the judiciary. At the time, 1994, 150 top judges, 148 were men, 148 were white. A lot of them were very decent, hardworking, thoughtful, and progressive judges who welcomed the change. Many were not that at all. And I think one of our greatest achievements in South Africa is to create a judiciary that's now looked at by the whole world as setting an example. And we had to start with the Constitutional Court. This was a brand new court, and we were aware of our special functions. We had to infuse the whole justice system and all exercises of power with the principles of the Constitution. And in many areas, it's been quite dramatic. It's not only in terms of abolishing capital punishment, which didn't delight everybody. It's not only in not subjecting same-sex couples to exclusion, marginalization, which I think the population has come to accept quite well. A whole range of procedures dealing with patriarchy and customary law, seeing customary law as living customary law, and interpreting the law as requiring a constitution requiring transformation. We were the judges who introduced the word transformation mm-hmm. into South African discourse very early on in about 96 or 97. We held President Mandela to account, mm-hmm. and he accepted it very graciously. We established that norm that the Constitution rules. So these were important elements for stabilizing the country and making the Constitution meaningful. It didn't give everybody a decent home. It didn't give everybody decent health care. It didn't redistribute the land in itself. But at least the points of reference were dignified and the things that we'd been fighting for. You know, you're speaking about Jeremy and getting on with people. I had the extraordinary experience of meeting the person who'd organized the planting of the bomb in my car in front of Estes. But I met him because he went to the Truth Commission. He had the courage to acknowledge what he'd done, and he wanted in his own way to become part of the new South Africa. He even helped with the reorganization of security services in some very, very positive ways. And it was very astonishing actually meeting him and looking at him, looking at me. This is the man I tried to kill. This is the man who tried to kill me. Now we're living in one country, South Africa. Can we get on? And if he hadn't gone to the Truth Commission, it would have been very, very hard for me. But the fact that he went there meant he'd done his little bit to acknowledge the wrongdoing in the past. It wasn't personal. He was on that side. I was on this side. And I like to feel that we've, in a sense, made huge progress in South Africa in at least reducing the rancor, the bitterness. But now is the stage to reignite, if you like, maybe that's a bad word to use, to reemphasize the hope that we had at one stage earlier on, the positivity, and the need to deal with the hard problems of the economy, of a kind of cultural hegemony and assumptions, what's called decolonization. We've got to face up to those issues, but my main point really is we can use the Constitution to achieve those things.
Albie, thank you very much for, framing the argument and also making the case via practical example of what exactly that democratic breakthrough was about, because the current debate is very skewed. There's an assumption or a narrative that has taken hold that Mandela's government, those of you who negotiated at that time, sold out, and that very little has changed, and that because there isn't greater economic justice, that what we have is in fact a sham, and that it is not enough. And many people are arguing that we need to press the reset button. Jeremy, from your perspective, you've been in one very defined camp. You are now working in a service 21 years later. You work in very impoverished communities on the Cape Flats, where things like gangsterism erodes whatever dignity and quality of life that people have. Your reflections on the democratic breakthrough and whether it was enough to give us a fighting chance to get to greater justice, to get to a more equal and just society.
Thank you, Karima. I think as we used to say, I always look at it through the lens of what we used to say in the 80s, you know, we can gain freedom formally, but it's the quality of that freedom that is important. And if I look at it from the qualitative perspective, I think the working class areas I work on, the Cape Flats, the freedom of movement of people, the freedom of association of people is really curbed by gangs that we've inherited into its fourth generation from pre-1994 days, and numbers gangs that exist for well over 130 years, who exercise criminal governance in areas they call their turf, who privatize our public spaces, our parks, our schools, for criminal profit-making activity, for criminal accumulation, who appropriate criminal value and extract such criminal value from areas that are supposed to be our commons, in which we should move freely, in which we should live freely, in which we should enjoy the services of the state freely. And the services of the state in those areas are severely affected, or need to negotiate the type of criminal governance exercised by these gangs and these what I call criminal entrepreneurs. So one of the challenges, what is good about where we are now, is unlike the past, you know, we have, for example, legislative tools in policing such as the Prevention of Organized Crime Act. Now, this enables us to tackle these groups and these large who seek such governance as criminal enterprises and tackle them and take them down, not only as individuals, but take them down in terms of the business side of their empires. And that, to me, is one significant development in law in dealing with organized crime in thing. And the successes we've had have certainly at least restored some degree of gaining that space from what they exercised in the past. And I think this is where the answer lies. You know, there's so much work that needs to be done to draw on the lessons of the 1980s.
Mm.
You know, we can challenge this criminal governments, but we need to replace it with something else. And to me, one of the things we did successfully in the 80s through street committees is we took control of the streets. If we could push back the enemy to the extent that we did before, and even make a dent in gang and other types of crime at the time through such grassroots structures of civic power, I think drawing on those traditions and those that memories, that institutional memory, would be important to build counter power against this criminal governments. And I think the other thing is what is significant now, you know, institutional corruption was never tackled in such a specialist way as than that it is now in our country.
Mm.
We have particular units, capabilities that didn't exist under apartheid. You know, the culture of corruption at political level not being investigated to its prosecutorial end has changed in our new environment. And to me, this is a particularly important development. We are now even using the same legislative tools, such as the Prevention of Organized Crime Act, to tackle such institutional corruption and prevent criminal entrepreneurship or criminal enterprises or gangs from gaining political control in parts of the Cape Flats.
All right. Gentlemen, thank you so very much.